That includes electronic e-cigarette things. Put a pencil in your mouth and imagine it's a cigarette if you want. no fire stuff other than the candles. They're fine, but no matches. Make sure you tip the bartender if you bought something from him to make him happy. Thank you. No cell phone usage. If you use pagers or buzzers or any app,
what's a pager?
I don't know. I've heard of it before. Something. None of that. No mini pianos. And there we go. All right. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, you guys are in for a treat because first we have Miss Jason Liu, the lovely Miss Jason.
Woo!
And introducing her is Jeff Coogan.
S.J. Sindhu is a writer. She's a Sri Lankan-American, genderqueer, PhD student in fiction who grew up speaking Tamil, which is a language with 247 letters. But S.J. Sindhu, first and foremost, is a writer. She's a writer first because her most devout belief is that stories are the things that can save us. Sindhu's stories are manifestos of the individual, hymns to the self and desire. And her words are saving bombs against unquestioning conformity, against the lockstep systems of world culture, in prose that swaggers. Sindhu the writer asserts an individual agency. Let me tell you something about being brown like me, Sindhu writes. Your story is already written for you. Your free will, your love, your failure, all of it scratched into the cosmos before you're even born. My mother calls it fate, the story written on your head by the stars, by the gods, never by you. Her prose reflects her personality. It never runs from the visceral or the difficult, with lines like, grandmother's coughs scrape themselves out of her throat and fall around her. This unflinching willingness to face the world also illuminates the beauty of the mundane in descriptions like, the carpet soaks up my footfalls like sand. Sindhu's prose reminds us that we are human and flawed and all the more frustratingly beautiful for that. S.J. Sindhu, the writer, is also Sindhuja Satyasiri, the 4'10" Sri Lankan-American, genderqueer, bilingual PhD student in fiction here at Florida State. As a human being, Sindhuja Satyasilam can't reach the top cupboard, but her spirit touches the higher altitudes. Though she's tiny, she's stable until she's angry. One of her nicknames is Baby Hulk. When you see Sindhu, you might want to grab her and give her a hug, but if you do, she might look at you like you just hugged Ernest Hemingway. You don't hug Ernest Hemingway. You shoot tigers with Ernest Hemingway. Another one of her nicknames is 20-pound Hemingway. It's a testament to Sindhu the person that she embraces comparisons to decidedly masculine comic book characters and writers. She's effortlessly able to exhibit a striking femininity while at once embodying the power and pugnaciousness of an angry, off-color, hulking toddler. She speaks out passionately against the privileges of the colonial imperialist white male, and yet she's able to see the humor in being compared to one. Sindhu the person is a cat lady, but her cat is named after a god, the Greek god of poetry, by the way, Apollo. Sindhu the person has a fear of the pattern of irregular holes. Yes, that's a thing. Trypophobia, it's called. She sees a honeycomb and her involuntary nervous system goes haywire. When Sindhu fashions her stories, even if the patterns of society may be shaped like honeycombs, she probes into the difficult spaces to emerge with stories of the pain and terrible beauty that hide underneath. As a person, Sindhu inspires spontaneous gifts from her admirers. One friend sent her comforting powders and bath soaps with an emphatic note, "I want to see your voice in the world." Since she's moved to Tallahassee 2 years ago, she's hosted regular writer salons, which have become kind of the event to attend in this town if you're a writer. As a writer, Sindhu is a generous editor, a willing mentor. She offers confident advice, never judgment, not mere praise. She helps her fellow writers see opportunities. As a writer and a person, Sindhu has courage and badassery. Hers is an aesthetic of beautiful rhythms wrapped in a badass swagger. If you know Sindhu, or if you know her writing, then you know that she holds her individual human agency and her writerly agency together in harmony. Sindhu was a 2013 Lambda Literary Fellow and has served as a judge for the Lambda Literary Awards. Her creative writing has appeared in Harper Palette, The MacGuffin, Waterstone Review, and elsewhere. And her big news is that her debut novel is forthcoming from Soho Press. World, get ready for this writer person. And Warehouse, get ready as well. S.J. Sindhu.
Transform a working class girl into a princess on the page.
I bend down, and she kisses me on each cheek in one long sniff. She smells like baby powder and metal juice. I sink into the couch. Already my insides feel fuller, some of the thinness worn off with the travel. Outside, through the sliding glass doors to the water-stained deck, Amma's vegetable garden lies cushioned by the overgrown backyard. In high school, I had taken the mean notes that kids slipped into my locker and buried them under that garden, in between the neat rows of cabbages and carrots. Grandmother tells me the plot of the show she's watching, and I try my best to follow. My Tamil isn't the most fluent. Chris and I don't use it at home. I can understand fairly well, but I have an accent when I try to speak. My stomach can't make the guttural sounds Tamil demands. My speech comes out sounding too flat, too delicate, too American. Tamil needs to be spoken deep and strong with big lungs. How are your studies? Grandmother asks, switching to English. I snap to attention. Grandmother was once a teacher at a Catholic school in Sri Lanka, fluent in English. Now she only uses it when she thinks I'm not listening, or when she really wants me to understand. I'm not in school, Amma. I tell her this every time I visit, but she forgets. I work at a company now, I say. I don't. I got laid off months ago, but I haven't told Amma yet. Grandmother nods slowly. My American accent takes a while for her to process, and squints again at the TV. Obama has stopped speaking for a biscuit commercial with a white-skinned woman and her long, straight black hair that slips across her back like water. How do you feel, I ask. Does it hurt? I always hurt. She shakes her head when she speaks, as if she's shaking the syllables from her mouth. I always hurt. But the fall, do you hurt from your fall? Fall? Grandmother looks at me, and I can see the way her eyes are fading to clear at the edges, fast losing their deep burgundy color. I didn't fall, she says. Grandmother was the first in our family to benefit from Sri Lanka's free higher education system. She got a degree in English and dreamed of teaching at a private school. She married one of her university professors, 17 years her senior, who promised to let her teach after marriage, and he did. For a year before she got pregnant. Grandmother's first maternity leave stretched and stretched until it swallowed the rest of her life. This next scene is a couple of weeks later. Lucky is getting more and more anxious about Nisha's wedding and starts to sort of impede on her time with her grandmother. The three of us, Amma, grandmother, and I prowl around the house for days like cats in a cage. We run into each other in the turns of hallways. We close doors too fast. Grandmother reminds us of the pain she's in, but denies that she fell down the stairs. A wheezing cough buds in her throat. She tells me every day to grow out my hair. During the day while Amma's at work, I sit with grandmother and watch her watch TV. I tell Amma I'm working from home. She believes me. When I was a programmer, I worked from home most of the time. Amma doesn't know that I haven't worked for months, that my only source of employment has been drawing commissioned digital art. The gigs pay enough to shut Chris's face about contributing to the household, but I'm not artistic like my sister Vidya, who could manipulate pigments and shape stories with her hands. She's the real artist. I can't do what she did, but I'm good enough to make other people's visions come true. When she watches TV, grandmother chews betel leaves with an acrid, spicy mixture that scratches the inside of my nostrils. She's done this since I was a kid. I used to watch her when we visited her in Sri Lanka. She wraps the thick, veined leaves around red-soaked coconut gratings, softened arabica nuts, slakened, lined paste, and spices I can't name. After meals, she chews coconut gratings that smell like perfume mixed with candy-coated fennel seeds for fresh breath. Amma doesn't approve, always scrunches her face and turns her head, But I've always loved watching grandmother's mouth ooze with red juice that she spits into a metal cup. The liquid clangs against the metal when she spits hard, her aim honed from years of practice. She let me chew after my 21st birthday, when she first came to live with Amma from Sri Lanka. I couldn't stomach the sharp flavor that spread like acid over my tongue. Instead, I learned how to fold the leaves, how to chop and soak the nuts, which mixtures went with what kind grandmother liked. I buy ingredients from a local Indian store and fold leaves for grandmother. Sometimes she tells me stories of Sri Lanka while she chews, and I listen while I draw. She tells me how she spent time in a refugee camp during the Sri Lankan Civil War, how the old woman in the tent next to hers had no arm, how the buses to Jaffna would be stopped, searched, sometimes bombed. We never knew what was coming, she says. She stuffs a leaf in her mouth. Her eyes flutter closed. She bites down slowly, savoring the way the leaf bursts and fills her mouth with juices. I draw pictures of a woman in a ratty sari, the tail of it wrapped around her arm where it ends at the elbows. I'll never be able to sell these or show them to Amma, who would cluck her tongue and tell me I should draw pictures of nice things, like flowers and beautiful girls. The woman's eyes pull with emptiness. Once, when I was in high school, my sister Vidya looked at my drawings and said, "Everyone you draw has sadness in their eyes." "They're smiling," I said. She said, "like they're burning quietly from the inside." "Your mother was a young woman," grandmother says. "It was a dangerous time for a young woman." When she talks, I can see red teeth and gums. Her spit clangs against the metal cup and slides down red. "Your Amma wants you to have a good life," she says. "She wants you to make all the right decisions." I shade the eyes of the woman I've drawn, hoping I can fill the emptiness in. This next section is from the middle of the novel. Lucky has rekindled her romance with Nisha, but is still struggling with the fact that Nisha is engaged to be married. One day it rains. When I come downstairs to drink my coffee, grandmother is sitting outside on the porch in her winter coat. Everything is soaked. Rain blurs her face. I run outside. "Come in the house," I say. Thunder grumbles overhead. The rain is cold, little pinpricks to my skin. It rattles on the tin gutters. It pelts grandmother's skin. She shivers. Her cotton housecoat clings to her legs. I shake her arm. "Come on, Amma." I squint to see through the rain and try again in the best thumble I can muster. "Bongo, bongo." She gets up slowly. Each step takes 1,000 raindrops. I pull her inside and slam the door shut. The rain has soaked into the carpet inside. I run and grab towels from the bathroom, and when I get back, she's still standing where I left her, soaked and shivering. I throw a towel on her head and mop up as much of the water as I can. "You need to change," I say. Her eyes look through me. "Yo rupa matam," I say. She moves toward the bathroom. I get a sweater and thick socks from her room and bring them down. When she takes too long to change, I pound my knuckles on the bathroom door. She comes out dry, her eyes clear. I wrap a blanket around over the sweater. She looks me up and down. "You need to change your clothes, Lakshmi," she says. "You'll get sick." I put on dry clothes and clean out most of the water from the carpet. Grandmother sits in the kitchen while I make tea. My hands won't stay steady. I watch to make sure she drinks it all. My tea tastes like rain on metal and musty carpet. I already know that I won't tell Amma about this. The days march toward the wedding. Grandmother starts to feel better. She still can't move around much, but she sits and watches her shows. Sometimes she sits in the kitchen and croaks instructions to Amma while she cooks. Amma grinds her teeth and puts up with it. When it comes to food, grandmother is lucid. Her onions have to be cut smaller, fried longer, with more oil and criminal choices. At grandmother's instructions, Alma stays in the kitchen most nights and during the weekends. You need to spend time with her, Alma tells me. She needs something to occupy her time. I dig out two pairs of knitting needles and yarn from the recesses in my old closet, along with a how-to-knit book from the 80s. A blonde woman with gigantic teeth and a workout headband smiles on the cover. The pages are crisp with too many spilled beverages. I give grandmother the thickest needles I can find. I try to start stitches in bulky, fuzzy blue yarn while she squints at the directions. When I get the stitch down, I show her. I stand behind her and guide her arms and hands like she's a human puppet. When I was little, grandmother knitted blankets, scarves, sweaters, even dresses and gloves. She bought the warmest wool she could find in Sri Lanka and sent the finished pieces through to us through relatives and friends traveling to the U.S. I hated wearing the brightly colored sweaters and dresses. My American classmates made fun of me for looking like a fog. Grandmother catches on to the stitch slowly, but her fingers still remember how to hold the yarn with tension. We knit to the beat of her chewing and spitting. Her hands tremble as she knits. Without me behind her, guiding her movements, she quickly forgets the stitch and tangles up the yarn. When I look up, she's trying to pick apart a knot with her shaking fingers. I take the yarn from her as gently as I can and I put it aside. She smiles at me and coughs. I stand behind her and give her a fresh ball of yarn, guiding her hands as they cast on stitches. This is the last scene, and it takes place a couple weeks later. Grandmother develops a really bad cough and is taken to the hospital. The smell of antiseptic and sickness crawls under my skin. Death is everywhere in the hospital, as common and concentrated as the disinfected air. Grandmother floats among tubes and machines, scratchy white sheets draped around her like a coat, the small room crammed with steady beeping, the rain, my fault. I sit on the couch while grandmother sleeps. Amma cries silently near a small window that faces the night's darkness, my fault. Grandmother lies motionless except for her raspy breathing and spasming eyelids. Her mouth hangs open. Amma stares blankly out the window. I should have brought her in earlier, she says. She shudders, her voice almost muffled out by the beeping of machines. She's been coughing for a week. Amma wants me to say something. You couldn't have seen this coming, I say. Amma looks me up and down. Why are you dressed like a boy, she asks. She doesn't wait for me to answer, just turns back to the window. Grandmother doesn't have dentures in, and her mouth looks sunken like a cave. I sit and watch her while the scent of the hospital works its way into my clothes. Grandmother caught me with Nisha once when we were in middle school. Nisha and I had hidden in my room to play out a scene we read in a summer reading book for school. A Ronin warrior slowly strips off his mistress's kimono, revealing her part by part, each second written in detail. Grandmother's face had hardened when she found us, her voice like glass when she asked us what the hell we were doing. Now I stare at grandmother's sleeping form, because when I look away, all I can see is the rain soaking into her dress, her face and hair dripping with it, her thin body shivering, rain pooling into the carpet, her eyes that day, the clarity as if the rain had washed away her dementia. And for a moment, she had herself back.
Next up.
for airing this paper.
Yeah!
Good evening, everybody. It is both a pleasure and a privilege to introduce Aaron Hoover tonight. On a personal note, I've known Aaron for the last 2.5 years, and I can tell you there's no one more stalwart, more indefatigable, more committed, more intelligent, more sensitive, and more of an amazing poet in this entire city. Full of beautiful, amazing poets in Aaron Hoover. Some contemporary poetry is a bit of an acquired taste. It takes time to unwrap the work, so festooned is it with gold foil of abstruse form and rhetorical obfuscation. Half the time, the work is mere confection. Hipster chocolate, made of remelted Hershey bars. Not so Aaron Hoover. She's as smart as those folks want to be. And her poems are a refreshing antidote to such stuffy, pretentious posturing. These are poems that level with the reader, sincere as a barroom confession, and strong as a whiskey that fuels it. But they are sober poems, cerebral, self-questioning. From my first encounter with Aaron's poems, I've been consistently stunned by their unflinching precision, their intimacy of address. There's a quiet but fierce honesty in the work, fueled by a candid introspection that somehow, and startlingly, manages to balance the subjective interior against the objective exterior without sacrificing the expression of either for the sake of the other. Sometimes I think that if the world were to invent a William Wordsworth for the 21st century, we'd just make Aaron Hoover, just as she is. These are poems that see into the life of things fearlessly, knowing that to do so means hearing oftentimes the still, sad music of humanity. Don't misunderstand me. These poems have both feet planted firmly in the here and now. One poem, Cantica Meretrix, my Latin's bad, it's probably totally mispronounced. It means Song of the Harlot. It's a tale of an internet it girl who becomes the victim of a vicious takedown. And it begins with an epigraph from a book, You Are Not a Gadget, by the futurist Jeremy Lanier. In another, the speaker waits on a New York sidewalk the morning after having been roofied at a party. My nights were transcendent in the flaws, she writes. And elsewhere, what wrecking it brought me. Well, Tallahassee. The reckoning is about to get wrought. Aaron Hoover. Not quite enough. Has poems everywhere. Bennington Review, Pratt Orchard Review, The Pinch, Prairie Schooner, Sugar House Review, everywhere, including Best American Poetry! 2015 forthcoming. Available everywhere. She received fellowship from the Kimmel Harding Center, or the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center, rather, for the Arts and the Port Townsend Writers Conference. She's editor-in-chief at Southeast Review, and I'm proud to be her lackey. And she's originally from Pennsylvania. Please welcome to the Warehouse Stage, Aaron Hoover!
This past summer, I got an email from an arts organization announcing that
Congress hadn't cut arts funding, that it was still $146 million. And I knew that our federal budget is around $4 trillion a year, so I started thinking about the value of arts relative to the value of other things. And this isn't really like some sort of NEA wonderful poem, it's just sort of a jumping off point. But the poem is called, "This Is Not a Productive Time." This year, the House agreed to level arts funding, $146 million. And I think I understand that. Parts and labor on a shopping mall, pre-tax income of a rich man. Even Congress can't fathom black ops dollars, nor whether they deliver any new means of control. It's none of our business, this ethos under which any lofty art is quantified. Last night at the bar, my friend, who is a poet and a woman, was asking me when she'll get the teaching job she deserves. And a man walked in, handsome in an approachable way. "Seems married," I told her. And she said, "Fuck that guy." When I nearly understand the world, I'm every vulgar bigot licking the last smear of petroleum off my dinner plate. I realize, like the beautiful, unfuckable man it just is. I am a good friend. I say things like, "Nurture your sadness," or, "We live outside of history now, like it's my job." Truly, I'd like to work for a think tank, ruminating usefully on how to filter cancer out of the river behind the kindergarten. I'm searching for a schoolmarm to look into my gilded eyes and teach me to write cursive. The other day, I bought a cell phone, and the saleswoman told me she is showing her sons how to make apps. She won't waste time preparing them for jobs like hers that are dying. In China, they buy phones out of vending machines. Even their diners are conveyor belts from which you pluck your bowl of intestines, she tells me. Must we become China? Or is it enough to lie down in a field of daisies or a train yard in Pittsburgh and die as our fathers did, eyes closed and trying to touch their own long-gone ideal faces? What I know about history is we grease ourselves up with another's blood and swear it's survival. We look each other in the face and lie. Believe me when I say our labor is unwanted children, our food made of crops from a nuclear field, a school of teachers, no students anywhere. What kind of deal are we going to make? As a teenager, I found a mottled blood mass in a plastic bag by the road, plied its bones with a twig. My boyfriend wouldn't let the bag in his car, though every day I allowed him to undress me in his parents' basement, in between rounds of World of Warcraft and Doom, afternoons bursting the skulls of his adversaries open with a semi-automatic. "It's not a child," he said. What I would trade for the balm of male affection, its half heart, unsaid, understood. Now I live on a bald patch of grass, swing set chains, twisting figure eights, apartment where I can see myself hiding out until I'm the last woman standing. Once I followed a guy to a bar bathroom. Cutting out lines in my compact, he said, "What kind of deal are we going to make?" I pushed away, his hand heavy on my belly, his eyes mugging my breasts. His plea, "What about your legs?" as he lifted my skirt to the bloom of my upper thigh. It's what days are made of for girls. What body part this time, and what glory? I'm not sure there's anything left of me or whatever palm tree oasis of okay I think other people feel. No inch unclaimed save this one. I did what I wanted, and what reckoning it brought me. So, Alex mentioned this poem, "Canticum Veritrix." I'm not a Latin person either, but I did find these words for this concept. So, canticum means song in Latin, and in Imperial Rome, Veritrix was the designation for a registered prostitute. Prostitution was legal in Rome as long as the only other man performing the service was registered. They paid taxes, there were other legal stipulations regarding that status. So, canticum veritrix, epigraph from Jerome Lanier, "You Are Not a Gadget." More often, trolling targets are chosen randomly, following the pattern described in the short story The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. It is as if a measure of human cruelty must be released, and to do so in a contained yet random way limits the damage by using the fairest possible method. They say I did all of it. No matter that I was home, binging on Law and Order, crushing cans of Coors Light, my avatar looked more like the harlot Rahab, the Empress Messalina, the oldest and still best methodology for devaluing a woman to strap her body to the cum-stained mattress of your mind. The rule back then was look anywhere but the camera, anywhere but at the ether of strangers, guys who just want to bone. I still won't lock eyes with that. And so I looked up or over, taking interest in the perimeter, simulacrum of every girl who ever flung or where are you into the wild west of the internet, parting her real lips for whatever it might bring back. One after the other, men came for me, boarded buses in lesser cities from New York, to hold in their arms the girl whose picture they clicked, me, the it girl who from the start begged for their takedown. I had to learn. But I have sympathy for the man who tried to ruin my life, a dumpster-shaped rabbit who'd been so clever online. He had to be ratcheting up snark for internet cred as a film critic. When at a bar one night, I looked him in his uncle kind eyes and tried to be his friend. Did I not get it while I was there? I didn't know rejection for some men is a mother, and when she opens her legs, she births monsters, three-headed, feathered with gills, on a Hagian plane, where the man who hacked my account texts other men and begs to blow them, sends photos snagged from a porn site of someone else's bruised tits, an engorged pussy that, while beautiful, wasn't mine. This is how I was born. Stood up from the bed and stretched my limbs into the middle of a thousand fantasies. Surprised so many stepped up to claim me. I, too, fucked the whore of Babylon. Though isn't that a version of solidarity, pitching a flag over the same scarred lands? And isn't it every other woman's reprieve, but this time with someone else? What an honor for a brief period to serve as the digital not me, the hot potato they passed, where finally the best word so many smart people could muster was slut. Maybe it's because I heard I'm down for threesomes, or wield the world's largest dildo, or sell heroin from a cunt encrusted with a mighty case of herpes, that I can't say I'm guarded without asking if you know what takedown means on the internet. My history shrunk to a capsule I continue to ingest and reject. I'm still, or where are you? But what are where and you? Honey, will you swallow a secret? Can you keep down the flesh of my heart? Next poem is about lost time. The title is also the first line of it. I find an earring in the bar bathroom sink, then lose 8 hours in the drain and come to hailing a cab. The discs of my contacts gone, but I sense a bridge in the wheels under me, the Williamsburg Bridge, possibly, a question forming. When I woke, sprawled out and blind on the sidewalk, how did I know to brush off and step toward a cab's headlights, arm raised? Back at my apartment, when I finally put on glasses and check my skirt, I find its fabric intact, the cotton of my underwear untorn, and my body silenced, too big for the room. No bruises, no trace, because if I'd been hurt, someone put the pieces back. In the morning, I walk to work like usual, sidewalks whirling with giant snow crash, bat away receipts and hamburger wrappers. A friend told me this happened to her. People reported she'd strung words into phrases that mimicked sentences, but some other mind did the talking. That night, no one remembered talking to me. Every party has a fulcrum where everyone is in control and then no one is. But where is the moment, with edges to crowbar open, the off-tune chord of laughter, a baby-faced man with a beard? My legs are dumb objects, the space between elastic enough to swallow all the men in New York City, or maybe none of them, or one, before I pulled my skirt back on and fell into the ether. What could I report? Around me, bags twined with other bags, bound for a continent-sized gyre of sea-drifting polymers.
plastic shards, soda caps, filth that once hidden and tangible, the details lost of whatever was done and who did it. Like bits of soap bottles built not to dissolve, they duck into sea fill and stay. Autopsy. After a storm drove a tree into my friend's car, she tweeted a picture, the new V of the car's roof aimed at the back seat where her children were. She said her husband threw a drink at her, yelled at her for reaching for her iPhone, not her kids. A few days later, they visit me to swim. My house has power and my freezer churns to cool the popsicles I offer, the six pack she's asking to buy. Her son Jake won't take a popsicle, pouts at being offered anything, and in the pool, her daughter laughs too often at the wedding moves. Her husband has gone to wherever men go to disappear. Jake and I race across the pool, and our dog paddles to let him win, though I affect outrage and he accuses me of not really trying. Why, my friend says to me, don't you have kids? I know how I'm supposed to respond, a reflex. Like I know how to slice water cleanly with my arms and legs. I should say I don't want children, or that I want them, and put forth a short-term plan. Instead, I tell her, some people find each other in the midst of paying too much for apartments and working low-wage jobs and bonding over youthful things. Others don't. Like we did, she says, about the man who called her a bad mother. Two new boys have joined us in the pool, their mothers smoking at its edge. And the boys soon fight with Jake, because he hovers too near, leaps inside the circle for the toy figure they toss back and forth. They call him a freak, and it's a word I've heard too. I turn to one boy, snot slug sliding down his lip, and say, what are you throwing? Can I see it? Then catch his throw expertly, because that's important to boys. I toss the turtle to Jake, who makes a show of plunging for it. It's okay, we're all playing in the blue water, diving toward the toy. Look, Superman is dancing under water, Snotnose says to me. And I look, then surface and nod, though I don't see, not past how many years I have left. Because I think when doctors open my corpse, they will find this story, all the versions of it. So it's been a great pleasure, and I'd like to be. Watching my brother's children has made me think about what family members do or don't do for each other, and sort of like some things you experience as a child lead you to be able to do things as an adult emotionally. So I was asked to write a poem for my friend's wedding. I wrote an Epithalamium. That's what that poem was called. Epithalamium on the ability to marry. This is for Laura and Jeremy. My nephew was put to bed in the next room, and now he and I lie in our dim castles. All day he cried. He did not want to eat any dinner, or build towers of blocks, or sing songs about farm animals. And I wonder if at night he contemplates his internal edges, as I did at his age, in this house. I want to speak out and whisper, hey, are you sleeping? From the hall, as I once wished a friend would, make an apology for how jagged childhood is. Every moment of completely new trauma, an earache fashioned with customized pain. It's years later, and I haven't escaped the sense of the world, though I felt on occasion the pressure lift. I have been understood. I grew up believing kindness was easy, believing it should be. Too many times I said, just do this one thing, and it wasn't done, however simple. Rarely did I ask anyone to perform the dangerous feat of stepping into another mind carefully, as in an unlit house with strange furniture. Such visitors quiet the animal mind, leaving only the human one. We ask so much of the people we want to love us. Tonight I don't go to see if my nephew is awake, but I feel his thoughts boiling through the walls. I'll never tell him to be brave, but if I love him, he will be. Parents do this for us. Friends do, hoping that later, when others approach, we'll feel capable, we'll ask them to come in. two more poems. This one is called PR Opportunity at the Food Bank, which might seem to be a strange title. But before I came to study here at Florida State, I worked as the communications director for a food charity for six years straight, but I worked there on and off for more than that, so I sort of tallied up it more like 8 years I worked in this place. And the poem describes some of the experience of what it is like to be a communications director for a hunger organization. It's a very strange job. PR opportunity at the food bank. It's Thanksgiving, and I swore I'd stop doing this. Another dinner service with a journalist trying to wedge my particular fable about urban generosity into the newsroom's mollusk cart. I stand with mothers, circled by hyperactive children, also day laborers, ex-prisoners, someone's grandmother, and any of hundreds of ministries that feed people in the Bronx or Crown Heights or Canarsie, yanking the hungry out of line because I need stories. I don't, but the wallets that open around Christmas time have to know who for. Tucked away from the kitchen, our makeshift interview space, closet stuffed with old clothes and Halloween decorations, shouldn't be an interrogation room, folding table and chairs, an awful light bulb, two white people, me and a cameraman, where I ask the questions. I'd like to say, I'm sorry I have to ask, and though no one needs a pass from me, I pretend there's no shame in your first time or accepting years worth of plates and bags of free food, no shame in lupus and HIV, the shit boyfriend, the children who have forgotten you. Usually I ask first what people like to do, the meals mothers cook at home, menudo or meatballs, a son doing well at math, what Puerto Rico is like when I say I want to go. Ex-prisoners and present-day junkies say they made mistakes, and I never ask what mistakes. What I can sell is that the food pantry is another bad break. Nobody would wait hours for a meal this barely good enough, even if it is free. Yet, people like us do it, making off another morsel of pride. Before we go in, I tell the cameraman to look people full in the face before he shoots, that when food is offered, accept. But his cannon remains glued to his glasses like a giant fly eye. He merely picks at our plate of spicy fried chicken. He can't help it. Out comes the soft-gloved insult, that most American of questions. Why do you think you're poor? And I apologize with my eyes, leave the woman forced to hear this before she eats back to the line. Surely someone will parrot back a few words for our story, the chain-smoking ex-nurse, part-time janitor, and I can go home to my wine, my couch, my nice neighborhood, having meted out some plateful of pork, translated to a language that can be understood at tables where there's always enough food. Most at home don't know how hungry they are for it, how the acerbic meal can nourish, like I do. So this is the last poem I'll read tonight. It's called Girls. And actually, the fifth season of Girls premieres on Sunday. So other than that, I guess. Thank you, Ashia, girl. thank you, Alex Quinlan, for like the best introduction a girl could ever want. And I was going to thank Zach and Ruth, but now I'm going to thank Zach, Ruth, and Kelly because you guys are like a threesome tonight. Thank you so much for hosting tonight and hosting always. And it's been an honor to read with some of you. And thank you all for coming out and listening to both of us read. I appreciate it. Girls. The point not that so-called ugly girls get laid on HBO, but they're mishaps. That if the single one is funny, two of them looks downright ambitious. They're the bitches nobody liked in high school, smudge-eyed and trussed up in complicated skirts, queuing outside the club with their amber vials of glow. Our kind of fucking up is why. Less millennial, more perpetual. Because we too called ourselves journalists, wrote for weeklies nobody read. We too got swept into green rooms on a glance, our stupid luck that a drummer sized up my platinum 6 foot Australian friend and invited us backstage. Instead, she ended up with the front man, singing to her outside as the drummer droned on about offbeats to me, his dark foil, whinging about desire, thinking maybe she's a little bit fat. Even before he pushed a shrink-wrapped CD like bus fare into my palm, I knew our hookup wouldn't do me any good. My nights were transcended in their flaws. Earlier, when my friend pulled him off me, her "what were you thinking?" draped between us like garlands at an anti-award ceremony, I wanted to be a woman who could take back some night somewhere, hang with those bad bitches at Seneca Falls. But I kissed a drummer from Staten Island because he wanted to kiss me. Does it get any less complicated than one Passover object burying itself in another? To those who would say girls is the third way of finding itself, who speak from the absurd position of having been found, I offer this grounded but ahistorical fuck you. I swear our girlish centers burn white hot as surely as nothing burns there. It was last call 5 minutes ago. Somebody, turn up the lights.